This disclaimer is a statement notifying the listening audience that any opinion expressed on the air is not reflective of KX93.5, its management, or its board of directors.
Good morning, Laguna Beach, Orange County, and to all our friends joining us today. Coming to you from the heart of the village in beautiful Laguna Beach, California, you're listening to Laguna Roundtable with smart talk and bold perspectives. Brought to you by your Laguna Roundtable co-hosts, Jim Kennedy and Dr. Ari Grayson on KX93.5.
Good morning, Laguna. You're listening to Laguna Roundtable on KX93.5 FM. As the only news and politics program on a community-supported music station, we have the duty to provide access to leaders, local, federal, and state, who represent you in government and affect your lives. Keeping with that theme, we have live in studio this morning Assemblyman Matthew Harper, who represents the 74th District in the California Assembly. Welcome, Assemblyman Harper.
Good morning.
How you doing this morning?
Well, anytime I can be in the Laguna Beach part of the district I represent is an excellent day.
Well, very good. We're glad to have you here. Okay, California State Legislature is a bicameral body consisting of a lower house, the California Assembly, with 80 members, and an upper house, the California State Senate, with 40 members, which my co-host Dr. Ari ran for. Good morning, Dr. Ari.
Good morning, everyone.
All right. The Democrats currently hold a supermajority, meaning more than two-thirds of the elected officials in both houses of the state legislature. Boo. Oh, sorry. Got away with me there. The state Senate currently consists of 27 Democrats and 13 Republicans, while the Assembly consists of 55 Democrats and 25 Republicans. Except for a brief period in 95 and 96, the Assembly has been in Democratic hands, meaning a majority of the elected officials, since 1970. And even though while the governor's office has gone back and forth between Republicans and Democrats, the state Senate has been in Democratic hands continuously since 1970. So for Republicans in California, you're kind of in a lost breed here. Unfortunately, there's not too many opportunities, but we'll see what's going to happen going forward. We'll be covering a number of topics this morning, issues including the recently enacted $52 billion gas tax increase, SB1. We're going to be asking about what's going on at UC Berkeley. We're going to be asking about SB 562, the Healthy California Act to provide free health care for illegal aliens, and attempts to make California a sanctuary state, along with information about being an assemblyman and what else we can cover in the remaining 55 minutes. All right. Assemblyman Harper, one of the hottest topics politically in California over the last 6 weeks has been SB 1, the $52 billion gas tax and DMV increase. How did we get into this position? As before, this money, California drivers were already the fourth highest taxed in America. Where did all of the money that's been raised over the last 40 years of gas taxes go? And welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to be able to talk about this. SB 1 is definitely the most talked about issue of this year in the state legislature. A massive, massive tax increase that's going to be faced by ordinary Californians throughout the state. This affects everybody. And even if you don't own a car, the cost of gasoline does affect you in terms of consumer goods, restaurants, everything that you buy is affected by those energy transportation costs that you have. The part that people aren't talking about as much, but I'm fully well aware of, is also how much it's going to hit ordinary Californians in the pocketbook when they pay their car registration. Remember that Gray Davis got recalled, and one of the big parts of that issue was his support for the car tax.
Yeah, we were actually talking about it this morning because we were talking about – I was quizzing Dr. Ari about when the Democrats had taken over, you know, the Senate, and he was right on. And then we were talking about Gray Davis getting recalled, and we were going through the governors. We're trying to remember which governor it was when the Republicans had that brief period in the Assembly. It was Pete Wilson.
Yes.
And then we're talking about why Gray Davis had got booted out was because of that. And he also gave illegal aliens – driver's license, which are two things right now that they have done and that are now applauded rather than vilified.
And don't forget about the often forgotten energy crisis that happened at the same time.
True.
As well.
Oh, with the pricing, with the Enron. That's right. That was a good one, too.
All three of those things were happening at the same time.
Okay, but on the gas tax, well, the increases, we've been paying money into this fund, and now Jerry Brown's going, we don't have any money to fix the roads. Where did all the money that's been paid in the gas tax go? Has that been misappropriated by state officials?
Well, I'll tell you what. One thing that I did, I'm very aggressive on the floor of the California State Assembly. I'm one of the only people who's willing to put forward what they call a hostile amendment, which is an amendment that's on the floor that would substantially change the bill to be able to do something and be able to have that debate and have that argument on the floor of the State Assembly so that everyone could be able to be a participant in it. So when SB 1 was up for one of the days, there was also a constitutional amendment that was supposed to be able to provide a lockbox, if you will, for the funds that were generated by this. Well, I offered an additional part of that lockbox, which is to guarantee that the wait fees that the truckers pay on our highways also have to go towards transportation.
Makes sense.
We've had a situation where since about 2010, that those wait fees have been diverted to be able to pay interest on bonds rather than transportation because we have so many bonds in this state. And guess what? All those bonds have to be paid for through the general fund.
Yes.
And it's starting to crowd out actual ongoing needs rather than paying for our roads and for other things. And so I offered that amendment. It got put down by the Democrats, but all the Republicans did support it. And also your gas taxes have been diverted in what was called a revenue swap, which was, you know, one of the last times that we had a recession. They figured out creative ways to be able to solve the budget crises, and one of them was to divert transportation funding. Well, the budget has increased by over $36 billion since that last budget increase. So rather than repaying that back, or at least backfilling those funds, it's been left to wither on the vine, if you will.
So now that we're going to, be throwing another $52 billion over 10 years to Brown and the Democratic Party just to spend however they see, or however, supposedly on transportation, is there anything that's going to guarantee that the same thing doesn't happen and this money is just drawn off for general fund usage again rather than going to road repairs that Jerry so badly says we need?
Well, don't think it'll automatically end in 10 years. There's True. No sunset date in this, and in fact, there's provisions for it to be able to escalate over time. They put up that Assembly Constitutional Amendment 5, which may or may not work, but if that constitutional amendment does not pass, that'll be decided by the voters. Then they'll be free and clear to be able to divert it toward other purposes within the their needs. One thing that I thought was also important, and I also brought a hostile amendment on this one when it came up this week, was SB 132 followed up. That was basically the bill to be able to pay off those who are on the fence regarding SB 1.
Oh, yes, like the Canela payoff.
The gold paved road to UC Merced,
yes.
If you will, and other projects that were utilized to get those people who are on the fence. And, you know, there were some Democrats who, you know, they were very it was very tough to get them to be able to come over to yes. And so there were special projects that were put in their district. Here in California, we have a California Transportation Commission, which is supposed to take the horse trading. It's supposed to take the deal making out of highway funding that sometimes happens in a lot of other states. But this bypassed the CTC or the California Transportation Commission, which made it very obvious and raw and naked as a political deal. My bill or my amendment would have taken out those special projects. But, of course, that was rejected by the legislature.
Okay. In a perfect world, then, how would you fund the roads and infrastructure that we need here in California to keep our business and commerce moving, as well as our citizens?
That's an excellent question. And the thing that I think is probably the best model in terms of having a good base that is able to fund your transportation has a nexus to transportation, because as they kind of pointed out with the road fees, with the wait fees that are from trucks, economic activity is often the biggest indicator of how much our roads are worn, and economic activity is often mirrored by the sales tax. Here in Orange County, we've had Measure M, which is our local sales tax, half cent, that goes directly to our roads in Orange County. And I served on the OCTA Board of Directors for 2 years while I was on the Huntington Beach City Council and mayor for the city of Huntington Beach. And that stable source of revenue has allowed our freeways to be improved in a way that even LA County and Inland Empire are both jealous of the condition of our freeways. We've been able to widen them. We've been able to get our intersections improved, et cetera, because of that sales tax increase. I would be someone who would be in favor of a portion of our sales taxes existing, not additional, but existing, would be taken away from the general fund and totally dedicated towards transportation taxes. And whether that's a half cent, whether that's a three-quarter cent, whether that's a full cent, That would depend on what our needs are within the state of California. But that way we could have a dedicated funding stream that goes to transportation, which does have that nexus, that economic boon. Now, of course, I would imagine, and I know, that a lot of folks in the majority party would oppose that because taking money out the general fund makes it so that those funds aren't available for health care, human services, welfare, et cetera. But I think that transportation is something that's valuable for all Californians of all economic strata because of how it involves our own commutes, our own ability to be able to see our friends and family, but most importantly, the economic activity it takes to get food and goods to us.
Sure. Now, I know while the gas tax hadn't been increased in a long period of time, I believe, how many years had it been since the gas tax had been raised?
And that's a very legitimate question,
right?
Is that the gas tax not only hasn't been raised, but as cars become more fuel efficient.
Right, you collect less.
And as more people have alternative fuel vehicles, yes, even these zero emission vehicles, I think my district seems that probably outside of Silicon Valley seems to have the most Teslas on the street.
Yeah, you'd see two, three a day.
People say they never see them, and I say I see them all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I even see the new SUVs floating around.
But that is a legitimate question in terms of how do we have sustainable funding for our roads, our freeways, et cetera. And I do think that that's an appropriate nexus, but I do think it's an appropriate part of the conversation because in terms of a dependency on gas tax, that's probably not the way of the future because it would have to be increased if you were just simply trying to keep up with the times. And I think an alternative funding mechanism is more important going into the future. The question is, will the majority of the state legislature and the governor agree with that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Dr. Ari?
Well, I had a couple of questions regarding your legislative record particularly. And one of the things I wanted to start with, and this came to mind just on Friday when Mr. Trump was speaking to the National Rifle Association, one of the things that he said was that we've had an 8-year assault on gun rights and that it's come crashing to an end, obviously, with his administration. But right here in our area, we've had a couple of major shootings. In 2015, we had 22 people who were killed in San Bernardino. When I was looking at your voting record, one of the things that I saw that you voted against was prohibiting concealed firearms in school property. What was your rationale for voting against that?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important to point out that what happened in San Bernardino is terrorism.
Yes.
And it's pretty clear to me and pretty much everyone who is experienced in that situation that that was the situation. When you're talking about radical Islamic terrorism, whether it's firearms, whether it's bombs, I mean, what we see in Europe where there may be less of an access to firearms, people are using trucks and semis and all kinds of other means by which to kill and terrorize people. So the argument that firearms is a way to be able to prevent a ban or curbing people's rights to firearms stops terrorism, I think, falls flat, especially when we see what's happening in Europe and other countries. But nevertheless, our right to bear arms is something that's fundamental to the United States. I'm someone who particularly has a high value on freedom and liberty. Those tend to be the two things that I consider most when I decide whether to vote for or against a bill and look through that prism as well as a series of other issues. But I believe that the Second Amendment for the United States is actually something that's very important. The Second Amendment, in fact, is what helps and guarantees the First Amendment. And there's a reason why it follows up right behind it. People being lawful homeowners and individuals and citizens who have a wide breadth of firearm ownership is something that I think is in keeping with what our founding fathers wanted, which was a great degree of power that's dispersed through the citizenry. It's also about being able to defend your home and being able to defend your property. We just had the 25th anniversary of the L.A. riots back in 1992. And I'm a firm believer that the riots didn't come to places like Huntington Beach and Costa Mesa and Newport Beach and places in Orange County, in large part because of the high degree of firearm ownership among property owners and residents. Because, you know, a neighborhood with a lot of firearm owners is a neighborhood that doesn't get looted.
Why, though, I mean, as an academician, who spends obviously a lot of time in the classroom. Why, though, would you oppose prohibiting concealed firearms on school property?
Well, remember, this bill, of course, is a California Democrat-authored bill, which means that it was even targeting, I believe on this one, law enforcement that may be a concealed carry or retired law enforcement that was concealed and carry. And I think that most people in the mainstream would argue that even those folks should be able to be able to carry, especially if there's an incident that what happens like in this situation when you brought up in San Bernardino, you know, that was on county property. And so if there's a, you know, a ban among people being able to conceal and carry in some of these places, then it does become vulnerable, whether it's to terrorism or whether it's to crime.
Just to finish out the discussion, though, on firearms and AB 1695, if you could help us understand that a little bit better. According to the bill's description, it prohibits falsely reporting the loss or theft of a firearm. How does that enhance or not enhance public safety?
I'm not familiar with the particulars of that bill. Is that something that was recently visited?
No, I don't believe it was. It was recently visited. I think it was about 2 years ago. So, you know, my understanding is that it would prevent people from, let's say, if you sold a firearm, having to report that, or if your firearm was stolen.
Yeah, and I know that a lot of bills were there on the face of it. It often looks like a good process, but of course, in the details, you have a lot of things that maybe did. Difficult or problematic, but one of the things that I've seen over time is that you know, it's not always what it is on the face. But on the other hand, we do visit about 5,000 to 6,000 bills per session, and so knowing the particulars of each individual one sometimes can be tricky.
All right, Laguna. Right, you're listening to Laguna Roundtable, KX93.5. We've got a special live show this morning with Assemblyman Matt Harper and my co-host,
Dr. Ari Grayson.
All right, let's get back to Dr. Ari. Do you have any more follow-up on that? I just wanted to get a tag in there.
No, I think okay. You know, I think we're good, but I think it was also a very good point that, you know, a lot of times we see these titles to a bill, and you really need to get into the details, into the weeds, if you will.
A lot of sunshine flowing through those titles that may not necessarily
And I'll tell you, the biggest culprit very often is I'll have people who will come to my office and they'll talk about a bill, and often they're, you know, citizens who are coming in on one issue or another. And sometimes I'll ask, does this make it more easy to be able to sue somebody with deep pockets? And very often the answer is yes.
Wow.
So even a lot of bills that seem like they're very innocuous on the face, they're often designed to make it so that it could be companies, it could be property owners, it could even be local governments. There's a lot of bills that are actually designed to make it easier to be able to litigate, and that is profitable for some people.
Well, since we do like to hold ourselves as a local program, let's jump to a local bill that was recently introduced, I believe, by yourself and Senator Morlock, AB 629, which allows the art gallery owners to give out free beer and wine, because that's been a very important topic in Laguna, as that has come quite to the loggerheads with a number of loggerheads and or wineries, with a number of art galleries being shut down and fined and given tickets for serving free beer and wine at the first Thursday art walk. I'm assuming that you guys are introducing that to get rid of that problem.
And so this is something that I was familiar with. I used to work at the county for just over 6.5 years. And so I enjoyed going back to downtown Santa Ana during the weekend for some of the times. And often it was for the art walks that they had there.
Sure.
That was where I had my first experience. And in downtown Santa Ana, like Laguna Beach, you have a concentration of art galleries. And a part of what they'd like to do with these art walks is be able to make it so that everyone can have a cultural and festive atmosphere. Mm-hmm. It brings more people to the galleries than normally would. You also have everyone consistently open. That's one thing that sometimes happens with art galleries is some are open during irregular hours. But
yes.
When an art walk comes around, almost every gallery, if not every art gallery in that place, typically opens up because they know that people are looking to be able to check out the art. One of the common practices is for the art galleries to have a little bit of hors d'oeuvres, maybe some soft drinks, maybe a little bit of beer, more likely a little bit of wine, and they'll pour, you know, usually like a quarter of a glass or something like that for people to enjoy themselves. And most of the situation with this across the state, it's been no harm, no foul. You know, people haven't come around, you know, trying to enforce laws and such in regards to it because you generally had no problem. This isn't a situation where art galleries are looking to become bars. They're just looking to be hospitable in general. And so when I heard of the situation in Laguna Beach where I guess someone was getting a little bit overzealous with the ticket pen, if you will, and it was identified that this seems to be an issue. I remember that in the previous session we had a couple of bills. One was introduced by Tom Daley from Santa Ana, and that made it legal to be able to have a beer while you're getting a haircut at the barbershop. There's some especially throwback barbershops that do that, and so that legally or formalized that as a process. Not to be outdone in the California legislature, you also got to have some equal representation. So Christina Garcia followed up in the following year, making sure that in hair salons for women, it was legalized as well. And so when I was brought, this issue was brought to me from Laguna Beach, I saw this as something that was very similar that had passed in two previous years in the legislature. And so I introduced this bill. And so right now it's in the Government Organizations Committee. And that's not a bad thing.
Okay. Just sounds ominous. And Government Sacramento just sounds a little scary.
Well, I'll tell you, this is a bill that has a jurisdiction over a lot of big deal issues. It has jurisdiction over gaming in the state of California and a lot of other very significant issues. But one of the things that we're trying to nail down, and this could be problematic because it's very easy to describe a salon in state law or a barbershop in state law. But one of the things that we're trying to do is get a good definition of what constitutes an art gallery. Okay. And that could be problematic, but we're working on that right now. That's the only roadblock that I see us coming with, is making sure that we lock down that definition enough so that it makes sense and it doesn't allow people who are kind of outside that it wasn't intended to be covered by this bill.
So when would we expect to hear about a committee vote on this bill?
So hopefully within a month or a month and a half, we should be able to hear it. As I said, I think that's one of the big things that coming up with an agreed upon definition. So hopefully that only takes a few more days, but it could take a few more weeks. If it ends up taking too long, then we may need to take it over and have it addressed in the subsequent year in the state legislature. But that's where we are on that bill.
Okay.
Because I recognize that this is something that's culturally a part of California,
sure,
a part of our art scene. And I want to make it so that people are actually engaging in lawful behavior when they're just enjoying an art walk.
Yeah, there's no reason to try to criminalize something that doesn't really seem to have much of a victim behind it.
Yeah. And I think that in the past, law enforcement typically used their discretion, but apparently someone, I think, overused the discretion.
Yeah, it was kind of a surprise when I started hearing about it up here. So
is no doubt a lot of the contributing factor in this is, you know, some teenagers probably, you know, got a hold of some wine
probably
in the gallery and came home drunk. And,
yeah,
you know, of course, the parents are angry at the art gallery.
Yes, not the fact they were bad parents let their kid go out and get drunk.
Well, you know, it's hard to control any kid, but certainly, you know, between the ages of
19-year-old.
Between the ages of 18 and 21, that's a very difficult issue. But
well, I haven't heard that as an issue, but we do have situations in which we would look. Typically, when people are in a situation where there's alcohol served, there's a really short ABC course that folks take alcoholic beverage control to be able to make sure to take appropriate steps on carding and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
I'm involved with the Orange County Wine Society. I'm one of their judges, and they also, if you want to do the pouring at the fair that the wine garden that the Orange County Society runs during the OC fair, you have to take that class. So yeah.
Yeah, and as I said, my intention is not to have a situation where people are, you know, going places to be able to pound stuff and stuff like that. This is just quarter pour or half pour, and that's it. Move on.
Yeah, right.
And in general, one of the very nice things here in Laguna Beach is we have the trolley system. So
yes,
you know, if you want to come into the village and enjoy a glass of wine as you're strolling through the galleries. That's wonderful, especially for locals where you can just get back on the trolley and commute safely back to your home.
Stumble or, home.
Yes. So that's a very nice feature here in town.
And I would note that bill is a bipartisan one. You know, my co-authors include Tom Daley, who's the Democrat from Santa Ana. On that.
So you don't see – I was going to ask you was do you see any Democratic opposition to the bill?
I think the only challenge is that if it's problematic to nail down definitions. But my feedback so far has given that people see this as, yeah, this is something that they generally support. It's just a matter of getting to an agreement on the wording.
Sounds good.
And I love the idea of working, you know, across the aisle. I mean, these issues, there are so many issues that I see here that we should be working with one another. These are nonpartisan issues. And one of the things that comes to my mind, I mean, Jim knows how much of a pet lover I am. so
How many pets do you have?
I'm sorry?
How many pets do you have?
Currently, I don't have any.
Okay, but you are a pet lover.
Absolutely. I always have. I've always have, but it's been difficult with my travel schedule
recently.
This
is true. I will vouch for that. Okay.
So it's been a little bit crazy, but, you know, in the spirit of working across the aisle, one of the things that I noticed was that PAWPAC, a nonpartisan political action committee, gives you an approval rating of just 7%. Now, Californians, much like myself, and certainly here in Laguna Beach, love their pets. So there are going to be two pieces of legislation coming up, and I wanted to gauge your opinion on them. And in all fairness, you may not have time to have gotten into the weeds, but one is AB 1199, which is the Police Canine Encounters Protection Act. We see in this country every 98 seconds a domestic animal is shot by a police officer coming to a home. And obviously that's detrimental not only to the pet, but emotionally devastating to the homeowner, to the pet owner, but also to the police officers.
Sure.
So what 1199 would do ostensibly is provide training for the police officers. Another piece of legislation coming up is AB 485, which is the Pet Rescue and Adoption Act. So I wanted to see, and what the Pet Rescue and Adoption Act would do is and the inhumane and deplorable, truly deplorable, breeding practices of puppy mills. So I wanted to see what your opinion is on that and how we might be able to bridge, you know, across the aisle and make sure that there's support from both Democrats and Republicans.
And this is an issue where I tend to be a very tolerant and freedom-oriented person on a lot of issues. I'm someone who tries to avoid what many would characterize as nanny state laws, if you will, where the government took a very heavy-handed decision in the role of how people engage in their daily lives or how people engage in their business and such. And we do have a lot of bills that are related to a lot of animal issues where I would agree with the people who are the proponents of the ballot initiative in terms of the overall issue. But the question is it the role of the government specifically to ban or to regulate this behavior? So like, for instance, in the issue of raising dogs and such, there are some boundaries, which I think are boundaries, but I think that those boundaries for me are wider than a lot of other folks in the state legislature, if you will, because of my resistance towards the government being so prescriptive in what people decide. But one of the things that I find is more important is that I would like people to work to try to affect the culture rather than to force people to do or change their habits through government. You know, I dealt this with this when I was on the Huntington Beach City Council. I kind of called them the Band of the Month Club, if you will, because, you know, if it wasn't this thing, it was another thing. So when I was on the city council, one of the things they were looking to ban was the plastic bags and the paper bag fee and such. And I was a very strong believer that that the businesses and consumers should be the deciders in terms of whether you had paper, plastic, or bring your own. And that plenty of businesses, whether it's Trader Joe's or Whole Foods, et cetera, weren't using plastic bags. Costco certainly doesn't. In that consumers could decide where they wanted to go based upon what their preferences and what their needs are. And similarly here, I see that culturally we're definitely in a situation which we're shifting to people adopting pets and people to looking to the shelter for their cats and dogs and other pets. And so the market for dogs or other animals that are bred in kind of these high volume situations. It looks like without the force of government that you indeed have people through their own choices are deciding to get their pets in ways which I think is more humane. And that's typically the way that I'd be able to look at it. I'll definitely take a look at this bill in regards to canines and in law enforcement. I haven't heard that proposal before, but that certainly looks like a good idea on its face, and I'd be happy to take a look at that one as well. But on the other pet issues, that tends to be the reason why I have a low score from that organization, because I view most of the legislation that organization supports is very heavy-handed in taking away choices from people, even though I would typically agree with the choices that they're supporting. I just want people to individually make those choices rather than the government.
Sorry, didn't mean to cut over. Dr. R., is this a Judy Mancuso effort?
It's the social compassion in legislation, and yes, Judy is definitely driving that.
All right, we're listening to Laguna Roundtable, KX93.5, with your host, Righty Jim and
Dr. Ari Grayson.
And we have with us live this morning Assemblyman Matt Harper. We've been pounding him with questions for about 30 minutes. And we'll take a short musical break here, and we'll come on back. We're going to have a little Led Zeppelin here going to California.
All right.
And we'll be back in about 3.5 minutes.
Spend my days with a woman unkind. Smoke my stuff and drink all my wine. Made up my mind, make a new start. Going to California with an aching in my heart. Someone told me there's a girl out there with love in her eyes and flowers in her hair. Chances on a big jet plane. Never let them tell you that we're all the same. Oh, the sea was red and the sky was gray. One that had tomorrow could ever follow today. Mountains and the canyons start to tremble and shake. The children of the sun begin. Plays guitar and cries and sings. La 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 la. Ride a white mare in the footsteps of doom. Trying to find a woman who's never, never, never been born. Standing on the hill in the mountain of dreams. Telling myself it's not as hard, hard, hard as it seems.
That was Led Zeppelin, and we played that for a very specific reason. Our 2017 K exclusive will be held June 16th, 2017 at the Montage Beach Grand Lawn. Montage Laguna Beach Grand Lawn, excuse me. VIP reception starts at 5 p.m. The event starts at 6. Support independent radio with an evening of taste and tunes on the Grand Lawn of the Montage Laguna Beach. Enjoy taste from award-winning chefs and tunes from Led Zeppelin, the most accurate and authentic representation of Led Zeppelin in the world today. The evening will be emceed by comedy legend Rita Rudner. Opening the night will be OC artist 92629 and Nick Brodeur. We are a member of community-supported radio, and it's events like this that we use to fundraise for the station to allow great programming like Laguna Roundtable and Full English Breakfast coming up next to be on the air. All right, the entire event will take place on the Montage's Grand Lawn overlooking the Pacific Ocean. VIPs will have a private area with their own complimentary bars, whereas priority access to seating and other benefits. For more information, contact KX935 at KX935.com to sign up and get your tickets and buy your VIPs. And we look forward to everybody being there. We actually might have some of the on-air personalities might be there also. You might be able to mingle with us. Ask us questions if you want. But
Not sure that that's sweetening the pot, Jim.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought it was. Wow. Okay. Okay. We promise not to show up if you do show up. Thank you very much. All right. Laguna Roundtable at KX93.5. We're back with Assemblyman Matt Harper, who's joined us this morning. And Dr. Ari, you had a question, another question that pertains to local issues you wanted to bring up.
Well, I think this has tremendous long-term as well as short-term impact. And politically, this has certainly been much the hot potato. But I wanted to discuss the desalination plant in Huntington Beach because in late January, the OC Republic reported that the Trump administration lists this proposed desal plant in Huntington Beach among the 50 infrastructure projects nationwide that the president has designated as a priority. Poseidon says that the plant would generate 50 million gallons each day, and it could provide about 10% of the county's drinkable water. But environmentalists say that increased salinity in the water could kill sea life and the intake pipes could suck in microorganisms and harm the area's environment. So is the desalination plant the right thing to do for the 74th Assembly District? And what should California be doing to prepare for the next drought, which is inevitable, it seems?
That's an outstanding question, one that I think is one of the more important questions facing California and understanding what our policy should be in the state legislature. One thing I want to make sure to frame it is in that I support a five-prong approach to be able to support our water needs. While we've received plenty of rain and snow within this year, people who understand California know that every year is either drought or it's flood. It's one or the other. It doesn't seem to have somewhere in between, and sometimes your flood years can be multiple, and very often your drought years can be even further. And one thing that I've been able to learn about California is, of course, we have a very short window in terms of what California is like. You know, we only have really good records since the 1800s, but the geologic record often points to droughts that go 10, 30, 50, or even more years. And so we need to be prepared whether we're in a situation of climate changing or climate being static. Either way, we have a situation where historically the California's geologic record points to long-term drought. And we have 38 million people living in the state and perhaps more coming in over the next decades. We need to make sure that we're prepared. And with that, I think that the one thing that is at the top of my list is making sure that we're improving and completing the California Aqueduct. Whether that does mean tunnels that the governor is pursuing, whether that's a canal that goes around, I favor making sure that project is completed so that we in Southern California get the highest value and highest return on all the investments that have been put in the California Aqueduct. I also think that water storage is absolutely critical. And even though the voters passed a bond for significant money for improving water storage because of CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, and a lot of other laws, those projects are being significantly delayed. And so I've seen all the water that goes down the Sacramento River that's on its way into the Pacific Ocean through the gates of the Golden Gate Bridge. But we have an ability to be able to, if we can build that water storage that was promised under the Prop 1 funding, that we can indeed capture a lot more of that during our wet years so that we can utilize that during our dry years. I'm also a large proponent of water recycling. Here in Orange County, we have been on the forefront with the partnership between the Orange County Water District and the Orange County Sanitation District, with being able to recycle water and be able to return that to the aquifer for future use. And other water districts here in South Orange County and now throughout the rest of the state of California have been replicating that so that we can utilize more of the water that we have. I'm also a very big proponent of conservation. I think that it's very important that we're not water wasters, especially looking to our landscaping, whether it's public or homeowners associations or even our front lawns, that each of us are looking at doing our part. When I was mayor of Huntington Beach, I accepted the water challenge that was put forth by the artist Weiland, and we actually were recognized as the city of our size category. We did the best in the entire nation in terms of water conservation. I was a part of the effort to be able to promote that as mayor. But finally, on the fifth step, I think that desalination is absolutely critical because all four of those other things still depend on the snow coming down or the water coming down. If the water and the snow don't come down, we can't even go through recycling because there's not it's not coming in on the front end. We need to make sure that we're prepared. And we have the greatest water source of all, the Pacific Ocean right here. And for us not to take steps to be able to take advantage of that, especially in the future, I think is wrong. Especially for subsequent generations, because with CEQA and with a lot of other laws, a project like this takes 10, 15, or more years to be able to build, and you can't decide to build that during the drought when you need it. You got to do it ahead of time. So that's why I tell people a project like this isn't for the current drought. It's for the either the next drought or the drought after that.
I actually personally blame Jerry Brown for the drought because if you remember when he was in office the first time, we had a large drought in the late 70s and early 80s when he was in office. Jerry comes back, we have one of the longest droughts we've had since that drought. So I think if we just get rid of Jerry Brown, the droughts would go away. That's just my thinking on it.
Well, I think drought's systemically a problem.
You know, in general, you know, I think your guiding philosophy seems to be very Jeffersonian, who said, government is best, which governs least.
Yes.
Last year when we had these mandates from Governor Brown saying that communities need to cut their energy consumption by about 25%, the folks of Laguna Beach, and I think in almost every community across your district, was very responsive of that. And even though we're very water-wise here in Laguna, we did manage to cut our consumption by the targeted amount. But there were communities like Rancho Santa Fe, which is not in your community, or not in your district, rather, where residents actually said, well, we pay a lot in taxes, and we're going to keep our green grasses because we don't want to look across brown, you know, brown lawns.
Kind of like the Beverly Hills of San Diego.
yeah, that's a very good analogy.
Yes.
How do we reconcile your desire to have government not mandate to people what they should be doing when somebody in Rancho Santa Fe consuming more than their appropriate share or their fair share of water compared to the rest of the population takes an takes a position like that? How do we deal with that?
Well, on one hand, I'm someone who also believes that you try to set up a situation for your infrastructure, whether it be water, energy, transportation, et cetera, where you try to build your infrastructure up to where people's individual demands are.
Right.
And I do think that we have an opportunity to be able to ramp that up, whether it's desalination, all these other things. And I agree with the conservation end as well. You know, I'm not someone who's in favor of rationing, but I am someone who is in favor of making sure that we do have our public education campaigns, that we do have our situations in which everyone realizes we're all in the boat together. Like, for instance, the Mesa Water District on the Costa Mesa part of my district, they did an outstanding information campaign that helped everyone buy into reducing their water use. They had the big users like the airport, Sagastrom, which owns South Coast Plaza, the fairgrounds, and a lot of other major water users, they bought into it. But also the individual homeowners were very strong into buying into it as well. And I agree, when you have a community or outliers that decide that they're not going to be a part of the team, it does inhibit the overall effort.
Well, it's like automobile conservation. What other people do does affect me. You know, if we're not conserving energy and we're more reliant than we need to be on foreign nationals for our energy source, It puts me at a risk because it means, for example, we have to send the U.S. 6th Fleet into the Persian Gulf to ensure the passage of oil. It's no different here in Southern California, where our water resources are so limited. If somebody decides, well, you know, for lack of a better expression, screw you, hooray for me, I want my green grass. If there's a way to impose a surcharge so that we are disincentivizing this overconsumption, because it does affect my ability to have good, clean, potable water for my everyday use.
And that's one thing that's, you know, I've learned over time on the council as well as being in the state legislature, is there's also a significant water energy nexus that not a lot of people know. Right. Is that to move and to get water where we want to, it takes an incredible amount of energy. When I visited the Hoover Dam and the California or the Colorado River Aqueduct, one thing that I didn't realize until that trip was that the Hoover Dam wasn't built for water storage. The Hoover Dam was built to have the electricity generation needed to pump that water from Parker Dam in Lake Havasu over to Los Angeles in the original Metropolitan Water District cities, because there's four series of gigantic pump stations to push that over a mountain, and then it uses gravity to move it across the desert, and then it pumps it back up the mountain again. And in order to move water, it takes a huge amount of energy, whether it's the Hatchepi Mountains in the California River Aqueduct or California Aqueduct Project or the Colorado River Aqueduct Project. And so every water use requires energy, and that's why it's important for us to have, I think, also a diversified energy portfolio that private business is able to put together. Of course, Los Angeles is through the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, but of course, through most of our area, it's Southern California Edison and a private or San Diego Gas and Electric that provides our power. And I think it's important that we utilize solar, that we utilize wind, but we also don't overlook the responsiveness of natural gas. Also in Huntington Beach, next to the proposed Poseidon desal plant, they're actually rebuilding the old, you know, the two giant boilers. When you drive up PCH and you see that giant power plant, that's actually coming down. And it's going to be replaced with six mid-rises in that same location. And whereas that old power plant, it took over a half day to start it. You know, in fact, whenever I would go by my bicycle, you'd have a situation where if it was turning on, you'd hear something that sounded like a semi-truck, except it was 500 times louder than a semi-truck to turn it on. But the new ones will be able to start on a dime. And so when you have a situation where the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining, the natural gas can be there to be able to even out those needs for our power supply.
And that's one of the arguments exactly that you're mentioning in terms of power consumption. That's one of the arguments in addition to the environmental argument against the plant, because they are so energy intensive. But at what point do you look at it and say, well, but we need to expend the energy, and let's find a way to be as energy efficient as possible, whether it's wind or solar or, as you say, natural gas, that helps a plant to ramp up much more quickly so that we do have the energy needed to drive the desal plant and ensure that our population has the water it needs, both for drinking and for agricultural industry.
And the part of the reason why I bring it up is because I say it's not a zero-sum game. Other sources of water are not energy intensive. Usually the alternative to desal is more imported water through the California Aqueduct System or the Colorado River Aqueduct System, and those are very energy intense as well. And so it becomes a marginal situation on what uses more power. And as desal technology improves, then that will become less and less energy intensive as they improve the filters and the technology that's utilized. And one of the things that's happened with the desal plant that was built in Carlsbad and is now under full operation is they built it in cartridges. In other words, as the technology improves, they can switch out those cartridges either early or at the end of their useful life, at about every 7 years. And so as technology improves, those desalination plants can also improve their own efficiency without a major retrofit.
Excellent. And then the last remaining issue that I see on that would be to deal with the notion of the high-density saline sludge, if you will, that has to go back into the ocean. Is there a way for us to rectify that you're aware of at this point?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, because two of the objections you brought up were the impact on the sea life and the saline ejection that you had. And in a place like Huntington Beach, the reason why the intention was to locate there is because the pipes already exist. Those are pipes that served the power plant for over 50 years, and the same was true over in Carlsbad, as well as other proposed locations. And so you don't have to have the environmental impact of having new pipes to be able to draw in the water, because they're already there. That's a part of what's being discussed by the California Coastal Commission, is because the Coastal Commission wants a different intake system, but building that would actually have far more impact on the environment. You have a situation where you're not talking about the sea life that's being impacted, are dolphins or fish, et cetera, because those gates that are on the intake have those gates that make it so that life aren't being impacted. What is being impacted is your microscopic life, like plankton. And I think that most people argue that there is plenty of plankton in the Pacific Ocean, and you're going to have a negligible effect on the level of plankton in the Pacific Ocean, whether or not there's a desal plant. And, of course, there's the issue of the brine that goes back out as well. And so that you adjust with the water that's going out in a way to make it so that it's something that can be dispersed by the natural current that's there. Fortunately, we live in an area here along the Pacific Ocean where we have the California Current that comes down from Alaska, and it's a pretty vigorous current as well. And so when you take the salt back out to the Pacific Ocean, its disbursement is actually pretty well done and pretty well taken care of through that. You just make sure that the water ratio with that salt is done in a way so that it can be properly dispersed very easily just by the natural currents.
Is there a foreseeable future in which we might see the desalination plant in Huntington Beach actually come to fruition?
I do think so. I do think it has and will take some time to be able to get it through the regulatory process. But we did see the plant in Carlsbad get approved, and now it is up and running. There's another proposed plant at the Camp Pendleton site, also serving San Diego. San Diego is similar to Laguna Beach and the surrounding communities in that it's at the very tail end of our water infrastructure for the state. So they know they're kind of at the last place in terms of water being able to get from Northern California to Southern California. Also, San Diego, like Laguna Beach, has very little ability to be able to tap into a water table or an underground aquifer because the geography, the geology doesn't lend itself to that, like Huntington Beach or Anaheim or Garden Grove or Fountain Valley do, which are above a gigantic aquifer. And so the alternative to tapping into the Pacific Ocean is usually imported water from thousands of miles away. And the equation starts making much more sense in South Orange County communities like San Diego when you put it into that context.
Okay, wonderful. All right, thank you.
Laguna Roundtable, KX935, with your host, Rady Jim, and
Dr. Ari Grayson.
And we have with us live this morning Assemblyman Matt Harper. Assemblyman, there's been a recently introduced bill, SB 562, the Healthy California Act, which I consider to be providing free health care for illegal aliens. Now, the bill is to provide health care for all of Californians, I do understand, regardless of legal stature. Give us a little bit of background on this bill, and how is it going to be paid for, and can California afford this kind of boondoggle when we're already running all sorts of programs and trying to pay off all sorts of debts that we have a hard time paying off?
I think your characterization on paying for illegal aliens is actually a very fair one, given the author's past record legislatively. In the last session, he had a bill that was called Healthcare for All. It's hashtag Healthcare for All. And the implication there was that state-sponsored healthcare should be available not only to citizens of the state of California, but to also illegal aliens and other non-citizens as well. And he's been very proud in proclaiming on that. In fact, he very proudly proclaims himself as an anchor baby. If you were Senator Ricardo Lara from the Long Beach area. I think it's very fair to be able to say that. Now, the bill that you're specifically talking about is a single payer health care in the state of California. That's definitely has its proponents, its opponents, and sometimes people can be both. If you listen to Jerry Brown when he was running for president in the early 1990s, mm-hmm. when he was a primary opponent of Bill Clinton, he was in favor of single payer. So that was something that's been an argument and from folks since the 90s and well before. But the challenge is actually overcoming the hurdle. You can make an argument on who's more who has a more liberal state legislature, California or Vermont. And Vermont went through this in the last session. And even Vermont saw this is a very, very costly proposition.
Yes.
Now, I don't know what the scoring has been for this proposal and how much that this would cost. But I am on the subcommittee for the budget for Health and Human Services. And I did ask because we had a hearing that was lamenting the potential repeal of the Affordable Care Act at the federal level. And I am someone who argues that I do think that predominant decisions for government on health probably should be made at the state level rather than the federal level. I think that your Tennessee, your Georgia, or your Colorado are going to have very different approaches on issues like healthcare than a California or a New York or a Massachusetts. I do think that there's room for 50 different healthcare systems, some of which may be very large in terms of the share of the economy, and some may be very small in terms of share of the economy, depending on what their voters wanted and what was appropriate for their states. When Vermont takes a pass on this, then I'm very skeptical whether California would actually do it. And in fact, that thought was backed up in Sacramento Bee just yesterday. The speaker of the California State Assembly pretty much was saying, I don't think that universal health care or single payer is in the cards for at least this session.
Well, that's pretty much kind of is an ominous tone of the speaker's not going to be backing, and that's going to be something that's going to be a pretty large hurdle to overcome. Assemblyman Harper, what committees do you sit on? We only got about 2 minutes left. I was curious what committees you sit on.
Most certainly. I continue to serve on Water Parks and Wildlife, enjoy that very much. It also has jurisdiction over our state parks, which includes beautiful Crystal Cove State Park and Huntington State Park, Huntington State Beach in our district. Also serve on the Labor and Employment Committee. Also, I'm the vice chair for the Elections and Redistricting Committee. As I pointed out, the budget with the Health and Human Services Subcommittee is what I serve on as well. So a very wide range of issues and a lot of things where I can very much advocate on the needs for the 74th District cities.
And I have one last question for you.
And we got 30 seconds.
I know we're almost out of time. What we've seen in other assembly races is having to raise an obscene amount of money, and I think it inhibits or prohibits you from doing the job that you were elected to do. According to the race won by Sharon Quirk Silva, she spent $4.3 million to defeat her opponent. That's over $40,000 per week that has to be raised every week over a 2-year term. How do you do your job and raise that kind of money?
Well, fortunately, I don't have to raise that kind of money to defend my seat. I believe that I have views that are pretty mainstream with most of the residents of the district here. But I do think that that's probably a good topic for a future discussion. I'd be happy to come back because I do think that that's a very significant issue and worth discussing.
We could take the entire hour just on campaign fundraising alone.
But probably.
Thank you so much for being here today to join us and your forthrightness on these tough issues.
Assemblyman Harper, thank you very much. We do appreciate it, and we will definitely have you back to Laguna Roundtable, KX93.5. And up next, Full English Breakfast with Jason Fetty. Have a good day, everybody.
Sweetie, knock me out. Leave the West behind. And my
shout that Georgia's always on my mind. In the USSR.